Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Punk Noobs Podcast number 210. Welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. I'm your announcer, John Gentile, and we've got a powerful, primal play of pugilist podcasting tonight in the south corner, standing at 6'2", weighing at 185 cracking pounds, wearing blue shorts. We've got the LA Kid, the Morning Glory Mauler, the Startup Sucker Puncher, Tricky Ricky Frankel. Tricky Ricky, are you ready for tonight's pugilist contest?
I'm actually more impressed that you were able to guess that. That was actually really close.
And in the north corner, wearing the light blue shorts, we've got the veteran standing at 6'5", weighing a magnificent 94 pounds. We've got the Northern Knocker, the Constantine's Cutter, the Niagara Brawler, managing editor Adam White. Adam White, are you ready to fight tonight?
The height was really the worst estimate that you could do. I mean, like all Canadians, Wolverine included, we're very short. So let me tell you,
Adam, are you really short? I've never seen you in person, Adam. I would guess that you were 5'10".
I'm probably between 5'7" and 5'9". I don't know if that means 5'8".
And of course, ladies and gentlemen, I'm your announcer, features editor John Gentile. Gentlemen, let's keep this clean. Touch your boxing gloves together, and when the bell rings, come out swinging, ladies and gentlemen of the Punk News listeners, podcasts, and commenters. Let's get ready to podcast.
Ding! Oh, your enthusiasm is tiring. So how are you, John?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm doing pretty good. Busy. I might go see George Clinton tomorrow night. I might go see Off on Thursday. So feeling good, baby, feeling good.
That's exciting. That's a nice bunch of shows there.
Well, it's my birthday this weekend, so I'm excited.
Oh, congratulations.
Nice. Well, thank you. I worked hard for it.
You gotta keep alive.
Gotta keep alive, gotta stay hydrated. You know, you gotta live for the moment. You gotta YOLO. YOLO every day. You know what they say.
I like the idea of you really celebrating like another year of staying sufficiently hydrated.
Well, you know what they say.
That being the real thing that mattered.
Well, speaking of the whimsy, let's move right into the podcast for a story that's not whimsical whatsoever. Anti-Flag have released a new song. It's called Hands Up, Don't Shoot. It's a remake of their previously released song, Police Story. Basically, the song is to raise awareness and to raise funds regarding the protests in Ferguson, Missouri, where a young fellow named Brown was shot by a police officer. It's not really sure what exactly happened yet, and it might not ever become clear, but it seems like most people think that basically Brown was shot while either walking away from a police officer or just standing there, and basically what people think happened is Brown was shot when he was not posing a threat to the police officer, which is against United States laws, and I would guess it's against Canadian laws, too. So I don't know if you want to get into a big in-depth argument about what happened in this scenario, because no one can really tell. But I guess a better question is this. Are you guys down with this song? And more so, does the modern protest song raise awareness? I know there's these stories with Woody Guthrie about how he wrote songs about coal miners, and then society as a whole, you know, decided to improve the working condition of coal miners. Can a band like Anti-Flag do that? Can any band do that? Change society's perceptions towards the treatment of a certain class of people?
What I'm always torn with when this sort of thing comes up is whether it feels opportunist that a band has gone and injected themselves into this situation. And I know that's not I don't think that's the correct assumption when you look at something like this, because I think if you look at the guys in Antiflag, like they're doing this to raise money. They're not necessarily doing this to get their name out there. You got to consider that, you know, that getting their name out there is probably not going to do a whole much for them at this point in their career. Like, people know this band or they don't. I don't think there's, you know, a huge amount of, you know, there's a huge amount of like a PR play that they're making with something like this. And I think that like they genuinely, you know, believe that they're in that tradition. They're in that Woody Guthrie tradition where they are trying to, you know, positively affect change through their music. I really think they're sincere about that. But there's the cynical part of me that's going like, you know, oh, Antiflag's involved now. Here we go. I know that's not right, and I don't think I should begrudge them for you know, trying to use their music to make a difference, nor should I begrudge them for having an opinion. But there's something about it, maybe because this story is unresolved, that just makes me think like really, like, you needed to go into the studio already on this, like that. I don't know if that's the right assumption. Ricky, is that the right assumption? I don't know if that's a cynical read of this.
You know, I'm kind of on that side too. I was, I remember finding Antiflag in a record store and looking at the back of their album. This is just for Antiflag in general. And looking at one of the back of their albums, and I just felt like it was the song titles were kind of just these fill in the blank anti-authoritarian, you know, Mad Libs almost. And then I listened to them. I wasn't impressed, and I wasn't impressed with this song. I mean, it seems like whenever something happens, they're on top of it and already in the studio. And I'm I'm almost impressed by how fast they got this out before, like, all the facts. I mean, they had to have been in the studio before, you know, any sort of autopsy was done, before right when the controversy started. That being said, I think the police, you know, handled the whole thing wrong. And it was, I mean, you know, I don't know if you saw the footage of the press being, you know, harassed by the cops during the protests and stuff like that. So they're not wrong, but it's just like it just seems like it's always, you know, Antiflag to the rescue. So I'm kind of with you.
Oh, God. I'm getting beat by the police. Someone call Antiflag.
Yeah, I'm running the risk of starting an Antiflag war, but I'm just not a fan of theirs. Kind of in the same realm as, you know, the whole transplants thing. They're kind of in that group for me. But
so you're anti-Antiflag.
Yeah, I just kind of feel like they're the watered down diet version of like aspiring to be what Leftover Crack would be, you know.
Well, see, my problem here is that I'm worried that my opinion of Antiflag's music is coloring my opinion of their protest action here. Where let's say this was The Clash, and The Clash were still a band, and they went and they released a song to do that. Would I have as much of a problem with it if it was The Clash? Or I don't know, because I like The Clash, right? Whereas I don't really like Antiflag. So I don't know I'm just, you know, going, oh, I don't like this band's music, so therefore what they're doing is dumb. Or if, I don't know. That's a challenge.
I had the same thing about, you know, Tom Morello. He does his, like, you know, To the Rescue Woody Guthrie acoustic solo act. And I love Tom Morello's, all of his projects, except for the, you know, acoustic thing he's doing, The Night Watchman.
Did you like Audioslave?
I was going to say.
I was, you know what, as a guitar player, I did look at Audioslave and be like, how did he do all that stuff? So yeah, from a guitar player standpoint, I did, but it got old. But I mean, and then, you know, he would do these, like, you know, acoustic concerts at protests, and I'm like, okay, you know, he's doing this it's like he's going, traveling around the country for every cause possible just to be to the rescue. And I mean, at some point, I'd say choose your battles a little bit more instead of just, you know, going to responding to every controversy that happens, because God knows a lot's happening now.
I've got a split opinion on this. It hinges on the following. Is Antiflag doing this to gain their own popularity, or are they doing this to genuinely help out? my first answer is I don't think Anti-Flag thought to themselves, wow, we can really capitalize on this and raise our brand, our band's brand. Like, there are people that would do that, but they're very sick people. And I think the number of people that do that is a very low percentage. So I think Anti-Flag is genuinely trying to help out the situation here.
No, I think it's I agree. I think they're doing it in – I mean, they're giving away the proceeds and everything. I agree, like, that they're not – that they're doing it in a genuine way. But it's just, like, they do it so much
Well,
that I don't know, you know. But continue.
That hinges on what I'm going towards. Jello Biafra is quite famous for saying, doing something is better than doing nothing every time. And so Anti-Flag is doing something. So, I mean, how many other people are saying, oh, Anti-Flag, they're always being, you know, they're always trying to help people out, but they don't really do anything. Well, at least they're doing something. But then the counter argument to that is, you know, modern day slacktivism, you know, like this bucket of ice water challenge, or, you know, yeah, Michelle Obama telling warlords, bring us back our girls, warlords. I know you care what I think.
Yeah.
So, but I wouldn't call this slacktivism because, I mean, they have raised some money. So, if you know, I would guess they're going to raise at least $1,000. $1,000 to this young fellow's family, I mean, it's not going to make the situation good, but it'll help out at least in the slightest degree. So, I commend Anti-Flag for this is not my kind of music, but at least they're doing something. And there's worse things you could do than trying to help out too much. You know, some people help out all the time, and what it amounts to is they say, oh, we're going to help out this cause, but they have so many causes that they never really help out any cause. So it's almost like vampiric, and that they're really just trying to make themselves feel better for helping people out, you know? I'm sure everyone knows people like that. They're like, oh, they're a member of this organization, they're a member of that organization. But they're a member of so many organizations, they can't really help out any. So I guess you could accuse Anti-Flag of that, but I don't think that's the case here. I don't think Anti-Flag is going to directly right any wrongs here, but I think they are helping out, if only to the slightest degree. So I think that's to be commended.
I just have one thing. I can't help but think that they came out with this so fast, which means they rushed to judgment, and rushed into the studio to do this before a lot more facts came out. So that's the only issue I have with this.
Usually I would agree with you to reserving judgment to the end, but I think it's pretty clear what happened here. And they're a punk band, and it's punk to, you know, be against the police. And
that's true, yeah.
I think it's pretty clear what happened here. I could be wrong, and if they are wrong, well, then Anti-Flag loses credibility in what they do, you know, but I don't think that's going to be the case here. And sometimes certain wrongs require direct action. And, well, no, I don't use the phrase direct action. Immediate action, then let's pause, wait, and see. And there's no golden rule as when you should wait and see and when you should do a direct, immediate thing. You kind of just have to go with your gut, and I think that's what Anti-Flag's doing. And okay. I think Anti-Flag made the right call here. But if it turns out that the young fellow was attacking the police officer, which I don't think he was, but if it does, then Anti-Flag's wrong, and I'll eat my words too. But I don't think that's going to happen.
No, there's the old, you know, DOA slogan of talk minus action equals zero here. So I'm sure that they're trying to live that sort of thing where they're saying, okay, well, let's actually try to raise some money. Let's actually do something instead of just, you know, complaining on Twitter about it. And I guess that's, you know, that's to be commended. So I think we got to look at this in perspective. They may very well have likely had this song recorded. I mean, it is one of their previous songs, so it may have just been something that they cut in the studio already and they just had it sitting around. And it's not like they've gone out and done like a major release or anything like that. You can buy it off of Bandcamp. So you know what? It might just be they said, you know what? Let's just see how much, you know, dollar bills we can collect and hand that over, and we've done our thing. And if that's the case, then I guess it's, you know, not something that we should be shitting on. But yeah, you know, it's interesting whenever a band like this all of a sudden injects themselves into, like, you know, an ongoing event that is pretty much like there's still tear gas in the streets at this point. So
they're still rioting right now.
I think it's healthy to be a little skeptical of everything, not like paranoid skeptical, but sometimes.
I agree 100%. If I might quote Jello Biafra again, don't forget question authority, and don't forget even question me. But actually, you know, I had one other thought while we were talking about this, and it just slipped my mind again, and it was pretty profound, but I guess we'll never mention it because I can't remember what I was about to say.
So the thing that you forgot to say was very profound.
It was. It was kind of profound, but I just can't remember what. Dang. Oh, well. What are you gonna
would
do?
You say it was world-changing?
It was world-changing. I mean, honestly, it would probably change a good 80% of people's lives, you know, but what are you going to do?
Ah, that sucks. So, Punch. So, Punch are streaming their new album in full. The record is titled They Don't Have to Believe, and it is due out on August 19th via Deathwish Inc. So you can find the full stream to this sucker on Punk News. John, fill us in about Punch.
All right, Punch is what I would call a rising hardcore band. They've actually been around for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years now, but a lot of people are really into this band. A lot of people are really into this band. Because for a long time, hardcore has been male-dominated, especially this kind of hardcore, which leans more towards hardcore as opposed to hardcore punk, which I'm not even sure I agree with that division, but people go by that division. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, it definitely has that sound.
Yeah, so Punch is more of a hardcore band than a hardcore punk band. They're fronted by a young lady, or at least she's one of the vocalists. They're from the Bay Area, and honestly, they're one of the most, I guess, underground, but popular underground bands around the Bay Area. I actually saw them, like, about 2 years ago. It was like, I mean, it wasn't billed as this, but it was billed as the up-and-coming hardcore bands. It was like them, Ceremony, Trapped Under Ice. What's the band with the rappers sometimes? Oh, I can't remember. Man, I have a terrible memory today. How the Gods Chill, whatever band that is.
I have no idea.
That was like another upcoming. Cold World. It was like the rising stars of hardcore. So that's who Punch is. A lot of people are really excited about them. A lot of people really like this record. I enjoyed this record. I thought it was cool. I think as far as modern hardcore goes, it's snappier, more compact, and more interesting than a lot of the hardcore bands out there. It doesn't succumb to chugga, 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 but it also doesn't succumb to the other hardcore foible in that, like, the songs stop being songs and are just like crash, bang, crash, crash, bang. Like, there's actually musicianship and songwriting here. What I would say, though, this album is not life-changing. I was hoping for something a little bit more daring, something with a little bit more unique attributes to it. Like, all my favorite hardcore bands, they had, like, there's something that makes them extra special. You know, the Cro-Mags, they invented hardcore, but they're also all crazy and Hare Krishna, and they're far-out guys. That's why. I'm not saying that Hare Krishna is crazy. I'm saying the guys in the band are crazy, and they happen to be Hare Krishnas. And they do far-out stuff. I love Integrity, but Dwight Hellion of Integrity, he's a far-out guy. He likes Charles Manson. He thinks he can cast spells. And that comes through in the music. I love Ceremony, but Ceremony is kind of more art school-y. They have, you know, they put poetry into their music and abstract soundscapes and that kind of thing. So I think as far as hardcore has been around long enough, and there's so many hardcore bands, you have to do something that makes you extra special. I feel as though Punch is on the verge of doing something extra special, but I don't think this record quite did anything super unique. What it did do is take hardcore and do it about as well as hardcore can be using the established rules of hardcore, if that makes sense.
That makes sense.
I mean,
they're good live, though. Like that's the thing about hardcore. It's like sometimes the record is just a record, but you really got to see them live. Punch is very good live.
Yeah, that was my impression listening to this, actually, was that when you get hardcore like this, that is like this kind of like loud and angry and fast, and kind of forgoes a lot of like the melodicism of kind of like the punk end of hardcore, I find it really difficult to listen to that casually, or like, you know, I can't like sit around and do work on my computer and listen to Punch. Like, that doesn't work for me. And the same way that I can sit around and listen to a band like, say, like Career Suicide, where you know, even though they're loud and angry, there's more, I guess, like traditional pop song structure going on underneath.
I can't listen to Career Suicide. Like, it gets me too jacked up. It gets me too excited.
Okay. But with a band like this, like, I love seeing bands like this live, especially when I'm not expecting to see them live. And there's just something about, like, you know, having a band get on stage, like, I'm not really aware of, and then, like, they sound like this, where they're just, like, loud and crazy and shrill and, like, you know, kind of scary, and you're just like, wow, like, that was really cool to see, but I'm still not really going to go buy their record. But I don't know, That's my weird relationship with this style of hardcore, I guess. But anyways.
Well, I agree with you, Adam, and I think that goes with my point is you kind of have to have something extra special, something that maybe deviates from the rules of hardcore. It's almost like hip-hop. Like, you can do the rules of hardcore expertly, but then you're so good that you're allowed to break those rules when you want to.
Yeah, all right. I knew that.
I mean, you know, I didn't hate this. I thought it was good, but my issue with this kind of hardcore is that, you know, I couldn't, if you were to tell me, oh, this, you know, what the track worth more than your opinion is playing instead of Not Sorry, I honestly couldn't not tell the difference. And I think that goes along with saying, with what you're saying, John, that, you know, they need to, you know, be more, you know, try and break a few rules to make themselves more, not original, but stand out more. I mean, I don't know, do we consider Off a hardcore band?
Good question. Keith Morris, I mean, if you say Keith Morris is Off a punk band, he'll say, no, we're just a rock band, you know? But I would say Off is hardcore punk, sure.
Okay, because I'll use him as my example. So, I mean, I could tell when Mr. Eustace is playing compared to when Hypnotize is playing. I don't think that that punk is like horrible or anything, but I couldn't tell, and that's when albums start dragging for me. So I can take, you know, a few tracks of this, but I mean, this is for a hardcore album, this is a long album.
Yeah, it is. But speaking of bands that break the rules, Jawbreaker is re-releasing their album 24-Hour Revenge Therapy. It's going to be out on October 14. And what's, I guess, most interesting about this is it's going to have a bunch of alternate versions of already existing tracks and two previously unreleased songs. I know Jawbreaker is a huge band among the punk news readers, mainly because they kind of, you could even say they're one of the first bands to like make punk rock as not a vehicle of being angry, although I guess you could trace that back down to Rites of Spring and Embrace. But Jawbreaker was maybe the band of the 90s that did that. So a lot of people are really excited about this. Are you guys excited about this? Do you guys think that Jawbreaker is deserving of the kudos it gets? Because Jawbreaker, very few bands get the kudos that Jawbreaker gets, and Jawbreaker gets almost no hate at all, really.
I think this is definitely an important record. I've always struggled with the post the kind of like the post release praise that ended up getting lumped on Dear You, which was their major label debut that came out after this. The sort of like the retroactive praise that went with Dear You, which really emerged during like the, I don't know, like the early 2000s kind of like emo movement, when that record became very important to that scene. That I always struggled with. But for me, this record is Jawbreaker, and this record really kind of exemplifies why they were an important band, like, and why like a lot of the stuff that happened around them at the time that this record came out mattered to people. Like, this is the record that came out right before they toured with Nirvana. This was the record that came out right before they, you know, made the big decision between, you know, are we going to break up or are we going to just like take all this money that's being offered to us and see if we can, you know, do a Green Day and sign to a major label at this point. There was a huge reaction, I mean, from the you know, the underground end of the punk rock scene when they actually made that decision. So they were, even at that time, a band that a lot of people cared about and a lot of people had a lot to say about. There was, I mean, shit, go look up. I'm sure it's on their, yeah, okay, their Ben Weasel, our friend Ben Weasel, back when this record came out. You know, he was right after this record came out when they went and they signed to the major label, you know, he was in Maximum Rock and Roll giving them shit about it. So like back when this came out, it was still very important. Jawbreaker was still, I think, very important to the scene. And that part I've always been comfortable with, and that part I get. I mean, I can listen to Dear You or not. I mean, sorry, 24 Hour Revenge Therapy. And I totally get it. I get why it's good. I get why I like it. I can enjoy it to its fullest extent, and I'm cool with that. I find that we've come back to Dear You, the major label record that came out after this, And we've decided that it's really good in sort of the way that, in sort of that revisionist way that kind of like latter-day post 2000s punk rock fans tend to be revisiting a lot of stuff and holding it up. And I've never been entirely comfortable with that. I don't even know if that's making sense. I'm just rambling. But 24 hour, yeah, it's important. So I'm cool with the reissue. I would like a copy. Yeah. Blah, blah, blah.
You know, this is a band that I keep getting told I should listen to, and this is probably the time to do it. So I'm going to check them out. I've been hearing good things.
I mean, the hard thing is that, like, they're one of those, I think what I'm trying to get at is there's one of those bands that we've probably beatified and we shouldn't. Like,
interesting.
Like the whole story that goes from 24 hour, which I think like in kind of like a shambly kind of replacements-y way, almost it really makes that bridge back from you were saying about like John about like, you know, punk rock, it's not about anger and but it's about emotion and stuff like that. Well, I think they get a lot of that from the Replacements, but they kind of bring it back more to punk rock from like those latter day Replacements records, right? So like I think that Jawbreaker's interesting in that they were super flawed, in that they had this really contentious relationship with punk rock and with, you know, with fans and with the scene and with their peers, and the fact that they did go and sign to a major label and release a, you know, a super slick, you know, Rob Cavallo produced record and then, you know, kind of unceremoniously split up, all unhappy with each other. The fact that they did that was really part of what makes them interesting to me, but I think that they're interesting because they're interesting, not that they're interesting in that, you know, we should anoint them.
I'm going to be a little controversial here, and if I'm wrong, Punk News Podcast listeners, feel free to email me at podcast@punknews.org. To me personally, Jawbreaker is where punk rock went wrong. And I don't really care if people want to make music that I don't like. I don't really care at all. But I feel as though Jawbreaker really set the precedent that, well, let me rephrase it. I like bands that are wild and exciting and dangerous and wild on stage and crazy. You don't know what's going to happen. Jawbreaker, I think more than any other band, established that it's okay to, you know, just be calm at a show and not get that crazy and be very reflective. And that's fine if that's what people want to listen to. I don't care about that. But I feel as though when bands do get wild and crazy and berserk on stage and into the audience, people say, well, it's not a safe space. You're violating my space. And so what it does is, I feel as though, to a very actual and real degree, it's neutered some of the more wild bands and has done detrimental harm to a lot of bands that could have been more exciting in the punk rock sphere. And furthermore, I think it pushed artists that would have been punk rock artists out into heavy metal. And that's just it's not a theory, a hypothesis, and I don't know if it's true or not, but that's just how I feel.
You're really saying that, like, the popularity that they achieved made an inroad maybe for this more touchy-feely type of punk rock that you're right, not a fan of?
And not that I don't care if people want to make touchy-feely punk rock, but I feel as though as of right now, touchy-feely punk rock is the majority. And what that means is when bands are wild, the majority of people say, you shouldn't be that wild. You shouldn't say things that we disagree with. You shouldn't say offensive things. You shouldn't say threatening things because it makes us feel scared. And I feel as though it has very much neutered the creative process of a very many, a large percentage of bands, or maybe not even percentage. Many great artists have been neutered by the current community of punk rock because it is so touchy-feely.
That's really interesting. I don't know if I agree with it or not, but I think it's an interesting theory because I think it fits into the narrative that I've had in my head for a long time, where at some point we, and by we I'm just meaning the greater punk rock listening audience, took records like, maybe not so much this one, but Jawbreaker's Dear You, I guess this one as well, things like Weezer's Pinkerton, and albums that I'm not even sure the bands themselves were all that happy with at the time, and we created this canon of music that we've decided we're going to pattern a lot of stuff on. And unfortunately, a lot of the stuff that ended up getting patterned on those records, which were, I think, in and of themselves, you know, fine, were stuff that we, at least by we, I mean like old people like you and me, John, weren't a really huge fan of. Like there's someone that has like, you know, that took a bunch of records that I think are like perfectly good. You know, 24 Hour Revenge Therapy, Weezer's Pinkerton, let's say like Refused, Shape of Punk to Come, you know, the one of the or Kid Dynamite, Lifetime, stuff like that. Records I think like on their own and in isolation are perfectly fine. And they built this foundation for what the punk rock bands that come afterwards should sound like. And I think that's what you're really getting at, is that I think a lot of those more, let's say, less dangerous punk rock bands, I think, come out of that tradition.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's one of those, like, who do you blame for this? I'm not sure. Because I don't think that was like that's the intent of a band like Jawbreaker. Especially like I think if you like you listen to 24 Hour, I don't get that sense from it. But like you put it into the context of what came after it, and you can see how it led to that.
I don't think Jawbreaker had the intent to make punk rock less exciting, if you will. I don't even know if Jawbreaker said we're punk. I think Jawbreaker just said we're a band, and this is the kind of music we make, which I certainly respect. But as with many things in punk rock, even their style or their facade was taken as a rule that you can't deviate from. And if a minority deviates from that, from the majority viciously punishes those who deviate, which I think is one of punk rock's greatest flaws.
Well, I what it's sounding like is that maybe they were influenced a little bit more than just for being like from the grunge era. Because I mean, this seems like they were the perfect band for to open for Nirvana. Because Nirvana, they're not all crazy, you know, mosh pit songs. They're also, you know, like Heart Shaped Box is not one of those, you know, rockin' tunes. It seems like these guys may have been more influenced by grunge, perhaps.
Honestly, well, you could be right, but we don't need to drive the Jawbreaker discussion into the gun. I think Jawbreaker is more organic. I think they just sound like they sound just because of the chemistry of the three guys in the band. That's what they happen to make. You know, I mean, Jawbreaker, they formed in like, what, 87 or something?
I don't know off the top of my head, but sure.
Jawbreaker formed in 86. And so, I mean, grunge was around in 86, but grunge really didn't become that popular until like 89. So I think their sound was already established before grunge existed. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah, so, okay.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not a Jawbreaker expert, but...
I want email about this. This seems like something people should be sending us email about.
Yeah, yeah.
Because someone's either going to agree with this, or they're going to be fucking outraged. So, podcast@punknews.org. If you want to argue or prove or disprove John's... theory of
hypothesis
of punk rock defanging. Yeah, I would like to hear that. Should we play a song?
Yeah, let's play a song. Tricky Ricky, you got a song, don't you?
Yeah. This is a song called My Boy by Captain Braindown and the Buzzkillers. They are from London, Ontario, Canada. My co-host Punk Rock College radio show. When I was still in school, he found this band just on their Bandcamp, and we were really into them. We'd play them a lot, so I thought I'd show the punk news community one of my favorite songs of theirs. It's called My Boy. They have a really funny music video for it if you check it out on YouTube. And this is off their album All Balls No Cock. And they are it's a more popular song. You'll definitely know who they are because their lead singer dresses up as a superhero with an all red body spandex suit, and the other guys are all dressed up as cops. So they're very hard to miss. So the song's called My Boy.
You won't see that with Jawbreaker.
No. No, you won't.
That was cool. Ricky, playing random Canadian bands is sort of my thing. So I'll give you this one. Speaking of the country of moose and...
squirrel.
Squirrel. That's not right. We do have squirrels. I'm sure everywhere does. Anyways, there's a story that popped up here in Canada a little while ago, and it wasn't something we posted about on Punk News, but I wanted to talk about with you guys because... It sounds absurd, and I'm curious what anyone thinks about this. So there was a radio station in Calgary, Alberta, which is, what is it here? 90.3 AMP, or CKMP. Anyways, they changed to a style of radio station called Quick Hits, spelt with a Z because, you know, douchebags, and which... In which basically, instead of playing full-length songs as radio stations are known to do, they decided they would cut their songs to short little versions under the, I guess, auspicions that they were giving listeners twice the music to listen to. The owner said that it was the first for a radio station in Canada and perhaps the first for a radio station anywhere in the world to do this. It kind of went over like a lead balloon. The station did this for about 3 weeks, and then they switched back to a traditional, you know, we're going to play entire songs format. And there was all sorts of pushback, especially from artists in Canada, where people were looking at this and saying that by doing this, they were messing with the art, that they were, you know, that they were taking something that was meant to be presented in a certain way and then bastardizing it so that they could, chase. You're forgiven. I don't know what you did.
Sorry about that. That was totally my fault.
I didn't even know what you were apologizing about.
I accidentally made a noise on the computer, but continue. Sorry about that.
No one could hear it.
We need to stop the podcast. Ricky, I don't know. I've told you before. You can't be making noise on the podcast, Ricky. I've told you 100 times.
Sorry, man. Listen, I'm sorry.
You better watch your ass from now on, Ricky. If you make one more noise. Listen, I'm tired of getting emails from listeners saying Ricky made a noise in the podcast. Well, guess what, Ricky? This is your final warning. You're on thin ice, mister.
Wasn't it Mark that was doing the scribbles or whatever?
Yeah, actually, that was Mark.
That was not me.
The funny thing here is that we can only pick up what your headphones are doing, so you could probably go watch like a whole YouTube video and we couldn't actually hear it.
Oh, okay.
You apologized for nothing. Way to go. people were not happy that this radio station decided to make up their own versions of songs so that they could fit more of them into a short time. The radio station, of course, was trying to chase, this belief that people are just have short attention spans or something like that. So anyways, I'm curious what you guys think about this because I don't know. I have mixed thoughts.
Well, I'll jump in first. First of all, this is idiotic. That's my thought. It is assuming that society's attention span is so short that we can't even listen to full songs anymore, nevertheless full albums. We should not be pampering that sin. We should be fighting against it and say, all right, I'm going to play you a 61-minute sleep song to expand your attention span. What I find more interesting, so I think it's stupid, and actually this radio station is a real jackass radio station. This is the radio station that burnt $6,000 Canadian. Like about 6 months ago, they had a contest. They said, should we give $6,000 to a person or should we burn it? And they had like listeners vote. And it was like 53% to 47%. So they just burnt $6,000, which I think is, I think that's absolutely horrible. Think of all you could have done with that $6,000. Think of the people you could have saved people's lives in Africa, but you just burn it for like a stupid radio gag. So I'm not a fan of this radio station. But getting back to the point at hand, should a radio station be able to alter songs if they want to? And that's a very interesting question because I love DJs. I love mixtapes. So if they brought on a DJ and he mixed together a whole bunch of songs, I think that'd be awesome. I'd be like, wow, that's really cool how he mixed all those different songs together. But this rubs me the wrong way. But I think I'm wrong in saying that he shouldn't alter the art like this. Now, because if I have to grant a DJ the license, I mean, this is purely creative license, not legal license, the creative license to mix together and cut up and remix songs for our enjoyment, then I can't arbitrarily and say, well, that's art and this isn't art. If a guy wants to cut a song in half, I think I have to give him a free pass, even though I personally think it's stupid. I think I'm wrong in thinking that it's stupid if that's what he wants to do. Another interesting point is the legal question. This is Canada, so I can't really speak to it. The reason radio stations can play music on the radio is because they have a license. How do you get a license? You pay a license to certain governmental agencies that grant license to the radio. Hypothetically, with that license money, the radio station distributes the money from the license to the artists that you play on the station. It actually doesn't work that well. It's done through ASCAP and BMI because
SOCAN in Canada.
SOCAN in Canada. The problem is they round up for the big artists and round down for the low artists. So Madonna actually gets more than they play her, and NoFX, for example, gets less than they play her. So NoFX probably gets zero, and Madonna probably gets 125% of what she actually should get. So the question is, though, does that license grant radio stations the ability to cut up songs like that? And the answer is it's very unclear. Would fair use grant a radio station the right to cut up songs like that? The answer is probably yes, although maybe not. Fair use, I don't want to get into a big fair use discussion, but fair use is you never trust anyone that ever says this is definitely fair use or this is definitely not fair use, because you never know if something's fair use until a judge says this is fair use or this is not fair use. in fair use, you can cut up stuff, but it's quite clear that sampling is not fair use. So if sampling is not fair use, is cutting a song in half fair use? I don't know. It's very tricky, but I'm just glad this fad died out. I don't have any answers.
Doesn't fair use tend to be ruled valid if it's to create if the use of the piece of the music, if we're talking about music, is sort of indispensable to the resulting product. So, for example, like if you're doing criticism of something, it obviously makes a lot of sense for you to actually use a clip of what you're criticizing about to help illustrate your point. Like that sort of thing usually falls under the fair use. I would find it hard to argue that there's like a necessity to cutting up songs like this.
Well, fair use is very so let's get into a fair use discussion, because actually I love talking about fair use. I wrote two papers about this in law school about fair use. I love fair use because it's such an amorphous area in the United States, and Canada's probably very, very similar. There's no exact reason why you're allowed to use fair use, but explicitly stated terms are criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, or research. And those are some of the reasons fair use, but there's other reasons too. But how do they determine if something's fair use? They look at four factors. They say, how transformative is the work? Is it for commercial or non-commercial purposes? They look at the actual work itself, the nature of the work. They look at the amount that you use, and they look at the amount upon the effect upon the potential market. So I guess the effect on something like this in the potential market, you're still paying for the license, so cutting a song in half, the artist still gets the full amount of money, right? So that would weigh in favor of fair use, you know? The amount substantially used, well, that doesn't really apply here. So I guess it's looking as – I mean, this is leaning towards fair use, I guess, to tell you the truth. But who knows until judge – but you can't sample. That's not fair use. So who knows, man? I don't know.
So I was looking at this, and what popped into my head was exactly what you said was – well, what about DJs that are mixing stuff? And I'm thinking specifically about that in a radio context. I mean, if you're within like the range of the Toronto radio stations, there was something in the 90s and I guess early 2000s. So maybe not that. Maybe the 90s. Let's stick with the 90s. There was something in the 90s that was very much that. So there was a DJ. He passed away a few years ago. Named Martin Streak that was a DJ on 102.1 The Edge in Toronto. So he used to, on like Friday and Saturday and Sunday nights, DJ live to air from various clubs in Toronto. And he would, you know, he would kind of take over the radio station from, you know, for like, it's like a 3-hour block or whatever it was in the evening. And they would basically be playing with no commercial breaks, his DJ sets from these clubs to the world. I think that, I mean, the money in it was that the clubs, of course, got promoted by him doing this and talking about the clubs on the air. But he would be playing songs, and he would, you know, do the kind of like things you would expect a DJ in a club to do. He'd be, you know, doing things like he's matching up the beats and the songs. He's fading stuff out and into each other. He's kind of playing with transitions between songs and stuff like that. He's probably cutting stuff a little bit to make that sort of thing happen. You know, and it was all great, kind of like it was like 90s alternative stuff and new wave and, you know, like 70s punk and all this kind of stuff that he was involving in this mix. And I remember when I was a kid and I was listening to it, and it was awesome, and it was just really cool to drive around at night and listen to this kind of mix. So in one sense, that was cutting up songs from their original intended length and all that for the purposes of a radio station. But I would give that a pass while frowning on the Calgary thing, only because I think that seemed to, and this is not a legal definition, that seemed to be far more in the spirit of that music and not just some like cynical ploy to see how much shit we can jam into an hour for the sake of short attention spans. And I feel that it's whether the intent going into it was, you know, artistic, or whether it was commercially minded that makes that difference, at least from a moral standpoint.
I would just find it frustrating. You hear a half a song and you're like, song's over, let's go to the next one.
Yeah, I was, you know, I never heard of this until I read this article. I don't think they do that here, unless it's like an absurd, unless it's like a really long song. Then I've heard, you know, DJ, like radio stations, just cut like a part out, or like, you know, if they play a rage, like if they usually played like Rage Against the Machine song, like Killing in the Name, they'll take out the whole part just for censorship, like a whole part just because of censorship.
Chickens.
Exactly. No. Actually, that's where I was going.
Do they not censor music in Canada?
They don't do anything in Canada. You don't understand, John.
We don't do anything.
Hang on a second.
Okay, hold on, I can speak to this.
I can too. You go ahead though.
Fight.
Okay. We tend to be far more lenient with like censoring of songs and stuff like that on radio. Like you'll hear, or on TV even, like you'll hear things that would be like bleeped out or censored in the US during, I don't know, daytime hours in Canada. I still think that we would have the version of Killing in the Name that takes out all the fuck you, I won't do what you tell me, though, I think.
Oh. Well, see, but that's the thing. When, you know what, we here in America, we like are so proud of ourselves for being so like open to freedom of speech and art and stuff like that. And then I see, so there's a ton of censorship if you were to watch like Comedy Central here. But when you go on Showcase in Canada and you see Kenny versus Spenny and Trailer Park Boys, it took me to a whole nother level. And I was so, when I read this article, I was so disappointed in this radio station, because that is just not the Canadian way. I thought, at least, you know, Kenny Hotz and just screwing over Spencer Rice. I mean, that was the best.
Well, if you don't like it, Ricky, you can get out.
You know what? I wish I had the luxury of leaving a country because of its television standards.
How are you repping Canada on this podcast?
I'm sorry, man. I was so into those shows in high school, and still am. So maybe I'm just immature. Whatever.
Well, speaking of global conflict, this is sort of interesting. As a lot of listeners might know, in America, and I think Canada too, Adam, records come out on Tuesday in Canada.
Tuesday.
Yeah. So in North America, records come out on Tuesday. But as it turns out, in other countries, like in Australia, records come out on Friday. In other countries, it's actually Mondays, and there's other days too. Interestingly, between Australia's Friday release date and the Tuesday release date in North America, digital piracy of albums released in Australia but not released in North America spikes. Piracy goes up. So it looks like the record industry as a whole is looking to settle on a day to release records worldwide. It looks like they're working to agree on Friday, but there's conflicting reports as whether or not they've already agreed to implement it by next July or if they're just talking it over right now. Do you guys think this would really make even a sizable dent in fighting piracy, like 2 days between Australia and the United States and Canada?
No. I mean, I don't even know why they need to choose a day. Why not just let people decide when they want to do it?
I'll tell you what. I'm glad you asked that, Ricky. And Jesse Lushes, who works at Alternative Tentacles. Jesse Lushes basically runs Alternative. He's the general manager of Alternative Tentacles.
Yeah.
He explained why a release date is actually important, particularly for smaller stores. The stores and distributors depend on these standard days to make sure no one's getting a jump on everyone else by getting it early. So if there wasn't a specific day, Walmart or Best Buy could use their weight, which they already are doing with exclusive releases, and say, you have to give it to us before you get to anybody else. And then everyone would buy it there, and the small fries get cut out entirely. So I'm actually a fan of... And also, honestly, I love release day. I like knowing when the record's coming out and when I can go and check it out.
I figured it was like...
I'm sorry, Adam, are you there? Ricky, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
It looks like Adam just got cut out. Adam, are you there?
Yes.
Okay.
Am I not?
Yeah, you cut out for a second. So after I just said that companies get a drop on the small guys if there wasn't a release date, so I like a release date. Adam, what was your reply?
Yeah, I was wondering if having a set release date every week, of course, probably has a lot to do with distribution. Like in that, if the truck from the record distributor upchain is going to come and drop off like the next box of stuff to put on the shelf, it's a lot more economical for that truck to come by once a week and drop everything off than to come like every day because, you know, this guy decided to release his stuff on a Saturday or anything like that. But yeah, the not squishing the little guy sounds good too.
I don't understand how this would combat piracy. Piracy's going to happen anyway.
I guess the idea is that people upload stuff on Friday in Australia, and people in America and Canada download it. But they're saying if it was available in America and in Canada, people would just go buy it right away instead of downloading it because they can't wait 3 days to get it, which might have some wisdom, but I don't think that would make that big of a dent on piracy. But
then they've got some numbers to back that up, and that wouldn't just be an assumption.
Yeah, you're probably right.
But then, what if it gets? What if the album gets leaked? I mean, before any of the releases.
Well, this doesn't solve that problem.
So yeah, I mean, I don't know.
So looking at this whole thing, if you looked at one of the articles, they suggested that like Friday might be the day they decide upon. And I had a conversation with someone who works in a record store in Vancouver on Twitter when this came out, and the sentiment was kind of that would be a horrible idea. I don't know why that's the case in Australia, but if you think about it, if there's any days when record stores probably have an easy time getting people in, I would imagine it would be like Fridays and Saturdays.
That's when I go shopping, yeah.
Yeah, so wouldn't you want release day, like the day that's going to drive people in, to be on a day that would otherwise be a down day? Wouldn't you want it to be a Tuesday or a Wednesday or something? A day when your traffic would otherwise be kind of shitty to get people into the store that day, not to boost a day that's already going to be busy? I mean, I don't know retail or anything, but that's what it seems like to me.
That's an excellent point. I definitely do go, like some record, I definitely do go on Tuesday to pick up specifically. And obviously, so in those weeks, I'll tend to go to the record store twice in a week instead of just once.
Yeah, like if it's going to be the day people are there anyways, well, then you've all of a sudden cut out like one of the days during the week when people are going to, I don't know, potentially come in for that very reason. But hey.
Yeah, on related news, do you guys know how Japanese CDs usually have bonus tracks?
Yes.
I hate that. Well, do you know the reason for that? Because honestly, I've probably spent about $300 ordering expensive Japanese CDs, so I get like the bonus tracks. Like, why do they do that in Japan?
It's reparations for the war.
I mean, listen, they do special pressings for vinyl in the UK also.
True. But it's something. I think it's something to do with release date. Like it's easier to get imports in Japan before, so they put on bonus tracks, so you buy it there, or something to do with taxes. Like if you buy it in Japan, it's more expensive, but if you import it, it's cheaper. So the domestic ones have bonus tracks. I don't know if anybody knows the answer to that. Send us an email. Completely unrelated. Silky Berlin has been Silky Berlin. A lot of punk news listeners might not know who she is. She's a proto punker and punk rocker from New York. She's been doing the punk rock stuff since like 74, 75. But she knows a lot of the germs and a lot of the West Coast punkers. She's been putting out a whole bunch of tracks. Most of them are covers with some punk rock legends. She did a version of the Beatles' "Happiness Is a Warm Gun" with Don Balls of the Germs. It's a really cool track. And we don't need to talk a whole lot about this because, I mean, it's not a whole lot to say. She did a really cool cover of Adam and the Ants' "Deutsche Girls" with Jack Grisham, and Jack Grisham is hilarious. Jack Grisham of TSOL. Jack Grisham is hilarious as he adopts a German accent. So we got some of these up on the Punk News website. Go check them out. I mean, they're not going to change your world. Well, actually, honestly, the Deutsche Girls cover is really, really cool. I suggest checking that out. That's Silky Berlin and Jack Grisham covering Adam and the Ants. And I recommend checking it out. Just a fun little project. I don't think it's anything super serious, but, you know, it's just for fun. So, related, something that the punk news listeners probably know a whole lot about, Hot Water Music is going on tour with other punk news perennial favorite, Dave Hawes, along with other punk news perennial favorite, the Flatliners. It's a Midwest West Coast tour. It starts in November, so not for a while. It starts in Georgia, wraps all the way up over down to California town. And it's the 20th anniversary of Hot Water Music being Hot Water Music. I know all the punk news readers love Hot Water Music. Are you guys excited for this? Tricky Ricky, will you be hitting up the West Hollywood show at the Troubadour?
I probably. The one thing I was kind of confused about on this tour was, why are the Flatliners opening and Dave Haas is taking the second spot?
Is that the case, or is that how we worded it?
No, I think that's the case. I think it's let me see here.
Isn't Dave Howes like pretty popular?
I just hang on a second. But I would also think that the Flatliners would take it. I'm gonna look it up on their Facebook. Hang on a second.
I think that like part of that is if this was, I'm thinking like, if let's look at the way that these tours kind of come together. So let's say Hot Water Music really wanted to go on tour with Dave Haas, and that may very well be the case because like those guys are good friends. They, you know, whenever they're, I mean, it's almost a cliche at this point that if you're going to go see a Dave Haas show, he's going to play Trusty Chords. If you're going to see him play in the same, you know, general regional vicinity as the Hot Water Music guys, they'll probably show up and play the song with him. I mean, there's a definite love in between those two artists. Mm-hmm. So if that was like, if that was the original tour, that was how the thing germinated. Like, hey, we want to take our buddy Dave Haas out and do a 20th anniversary tour. And then it's like, hey, we need a third. Well, then, you know, then the Flats come in via the booking agent or something like that. Like that could have been how this sort of thing came together. So I wouldn't worry too much about that, I guess.
No. I'm just curious. I am looking at the tour poster, and it is in fact the order that's on on Punk News.
I really liked actually more in repeat listens Dave's last record, and I think he's really good live. So yeah. Hey, cool. That's
I'll probably end up going.
I won't because it's nowhere near me, but I would. If it was. Oh, final story of the evening. John, do you want me to read this one?
Yeah, I can't bear reading it, Adam. You have to take it. You have to take it.
All right. So this weekend, Gwar and its fans paid tribute to deceased Gwar frontman Odorous Arungus, who passed away in March. Gwar's longest surviving slave, Dave Brocky, who also passed away in March, was also saluted. Numerous people, including Jello Biafra and Randy Blythe of Lamb of God, played tribute to Odorous at a Friday memorial. Following the speeches, Odorous' body was placed on the SS boat at Haddad's Lake, Virginia, in a Viking/galactic scumdog style. A flaming arrow was then shot at the boat, setting it ablaze and cremating the remains of the interstellar terror. So the next day, several bands played the Gwarbecue, including the Meatmen, the Misfits, and
Body Count.
Where am I? Wow, okay. I can't read sentences anymore. Sorry about that. And Body Count. Following that, Gwar played what was likely to be their first ever non-Odorous show. They introduced a new scumdog called
Blothar.
Blothar. Oh, that's not an I. See, I can't read. There we go. Who looks surprisingly like Gwar slave Mike Bishop. During Gwar's early years, Bishop bore an uncanny resemblance to Gwar bassist Beefcake the Mighty, but that was probably a coincidence as well. So, Gwar has stated that they are already working on new material and plan a tour. The band last released the album Battle Maximus in 2013. We spoke to Gwar multiple times on Punk News, most recently last September. You can find the link to that on the org to see that. And there's all sorts of videos that you can check of the memorial. There's videos of the Viking funeral, of Jello speaking, of the actual band's full set from the next day. So there's all sorts of stuff there that you should go check out. John, you are the resident Gwar champion on the org.
I am. You know, I frankly, I've been boo-hooing the passing of Dave Brocky on the Punk News podcast for some time, and I hope people don't think I'm being facetious or making light of it. Usually when a celebrity dies, like I don't mean to talk bad about Robin Williams. I think Robin Williams is a phenomenal actor, but when he passed away, it didn't really affect my life whatsoever, you know. The fact is, and Adam, you probably have experienced this, and maybe some of the older listeners have, the older you get, the more tragedies, I guess, you have in your own personal life, if that's how you want to phrase it. So celebrities, the passing of celebrities and the trials of celebrities mean less to you. Adam, would you agree with that?
As someone that has delivered like three, if not four, eulogies, yes.
Right. So I think Robin Williams is great, but frankly, like, I can't get sad about Robin Williams, because if I get sad about Robin Williams, you have to get sad about, you know, the fact is artists are getting older. So what are you going to be sad every day of the week because somebody passed away? But I guess Gwar was one of the first bands that I really, really got into. And I had the pleasure of interviewing Dave Brocky and Odorous separately many, many times, probably about 7 or 8 times. And so his passing was quite a surprise, and it really did bum me out because Gwar used to be this thing of such joy, such fun. And so for it to end in such a tragic fashion, an unexpected death, is quite sad. And, I mean, certainly Dave Brocky and I weren't friends, but I would say we were friendly acquaintances. I hope I'm not overstepping my boundaries because he knew who I was, and I don't want to pat myself on the back, but I do know for a fact that of our interviews, he enjoyed our interviews. But the fact is, I mean, how long can I boohoo the guy for? And it's not like I'm sitting at home crying, but I would be lying if I didn't get sad, you know, for a few moments every few weeks when I think about it. But the fact is, Dave Brocky's passed away, and Gwar's continuing onward, as Dave Brocky had expressly stated he wanted Gwar to do after he died. So I was surprised with the new set. I think the new vocalist, Blothar, Blothar, we'll just break the facade here. Blothar is Mike Bishop, who used to be Beefcake the Mighty. I was concerned because Beefcake the Mighty always sings in a high-pitched voice. I wasn't sure that was going to carry over to the lead vocalist. Thankfully, Mike Bishop doesn't use his Beefcake the Mighty voice. He does a sort of halfway between Beefcake the Mighty and Otis Arunga's voice. So I really liked his vocals on the new performance. I think he's doing pretty much as good as you can expect, filling in for Odorous Arungus's shoes. No one can ever replicate Odorous Arungus, so thankfully they're not trying to do that, but they are continuing onward, which he explicitly wanted them to do. So I support Gwar, and I'm definitely going to see them. The point is, I guess I just have to say to myself, listen, you can't get that bummed out over somebody you hardly didn't know, you know? So I'll have to toughen up and say, listen, soldier onward, Gwar is still a great band, and they are. I'm looking forward to seeing them live again. So I've been boo-hooing on the Punk News podcast and the website, you know, since March, since Dave Brocky passed away. So I think I won't do that anymore. So I look forward to see what Gwar has to do in the future. What can I say? Spend time with your family.
I gotta say, I watched most of the videos. Yeah, I did. Jelly Offer's speech was spectacular. I mean, that was, I don't know if you guys watched it. It was really good. It was funny. It was heartfelt. It was perfect. It was a really good eulogy. Did you guys listen to it?
Yeah. Jello is a master wordsmith, and I thought Jello handed it perfectly. It was the excellent. It was the perfect medium between sappiness and funniness. Ricky, yeah. I'm interested in what you got. I felt as though some of the crowd and even some of the speakers didn't have enough respect or deference. They were a little too, I don't know, drunk or randy, you know, for this type of thing. But on the other hand, it is Dave Brocky. Dave Brocky's not a stiff. He was always cracking jokes. So did you think the crowd and the other speakers, not Jello, Jello nailed it, did the other speakers have the appropriate decorum for something like this?
Well, I mean, I think they had the right decorum for when the guy shot the arrow at the boat. But, at the same time, you're at a Gwar show, you know?
Mm.
And I think I have a feeling that Odorous would have, if he said that, you know, we want Gwar to continue, that's it. That's it starting to continue.
Mm. I did like how they had the cuttlefish of Cthulhu on the that's Odorous's gigantic like dick, and I like how they had it pointed upwards, like straight up. So yeah. I wonder if that was a symbolism because I don't know if you, in undergrad I did Egyptology, and one of the recurring themes through all ancient civilizations is what's called an axis mundi. An axis mundi is basically some type of structure, usually a cylinder shooting straight up, and it represents the connection with the heavens. And often axis mundis are represented as phallic symbols, and it's sort of like a circular motif in that the creation of life, you know, the wiener represents the creation of life and fertility. and so that is the connection to the divine. And that's why, I mean, there are books and books on this, why on how an axis mundi is a phallic symbol often. So I liked how, because Otis Arungus is dead, they put his wiener on the boat and had it sticking straight up, just like an axis mundi, sort of a reference to the ancient cultures. I don't know if that was on purpose or not, but I thought it was clever.
Those are the best few sentences ever spoken on this.
It looked like it was. It looked like it was a solemn but kind of a good time too.
Yeah, I mean that was the kind of nice thing about seeing this is that like it definitely. Gwar is not a band that really does anything subtly or without a certain level of zaniness. So I guess it's kind of fitting that a Viking funeral that they put together had that kind of level of craziness with it.
Well, fair. I don't know if there's anything else that we can say, is there?
I don't know. Have you got a song to kick us off?
I've got something entirely not related. As everyone knows, I'm a huge fan of the Vivian Girls. I'm a huge fan of all the Vivian Girls spinoffs. I'm a huge fan of Sarah, huge fan of the babies. Well, I guess you could say lead Vivian girl, Kathy Ramone, is about to release her first solo LP. It's coming out next week, and I've heard – actually, you can hear on Pitchfork. You can get there through the Punk News website. It's a little bit surprise. It's almost more – what's what I'm looking for? What's My Bloody Valentine? What do you call that?
Shoegaze.
It's almost shoegaze, to tell you the truth, or spooky, or ethereal. It's not – girl groupish like her early stuff. I'm digging it. This is a track off the brand new LP out next week. The LP is called The Time Has Come. The artist is Kathy Ramone, and this track is called Hanging On. On the Punk News podcast, wrapping it up. We had some laughs. We had some tears. How you guys feeling? Are you guys feeling emotionally cleansed?
Oh, yeah. I'm ready to keep going.
I'm pretty cleansed.
All right. Well, everyone, you know, they say cleanliness is next to godliness, bringing us back to our Axis Mundi motif for tonight's podcast. Thanks again for listening. You can reach us at podcast@punknews.org, and we'll see you next week.